Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. It has been the dream of many a young American woman to become a cheerleader. Indeed, cheerleading lies at the heart of our sports culture. So what is its history? That's the subject of Eileen Dugan's interview this week with Mary Ellen Hansen. And after that, we'll be hearing from historian Sherman Dorn on the prospects for a continued unity in the United States against a common enemy in the wake of the tragic events of September 11th. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. 23 years ago this week, American cult leader Jim Jones and his group of several hundred followers committed mass suicide in what became known as the Jonestown Massacre. Jones, a self-proclaimed messiah of the People's Temple, a San Francisco-based evangelist group, promised his followers a utopia in an agriculture commune amidst the jungles of Guyana in South America. During his days in Indiana during the 1950s, Jones gained a reputation as a charismatic leader, but after moving his evangelical group's headquarters to Northern California in 1965, he was increasingly corrupted by the exercise of power. Facing charges from journalists and defectors of inappropriately using cult members' funds, Jones and his followers left the United States and set up a community in Guyana where threats of blackmail, beatings, and death kept his followers loyal to the cause. On November 14, 1978, a group of journalists and relatives of cultists led by U.S. Representative Leo Ryan of California arrived to investigate Jones's alleged abuses. 4 days later, Ryan and four others were brutally murdered. Knowing that those who escaped would go to authorities, Jones implemented his plan for a ritual mass suicide. On the night of November 18, 1978, he commanded his followers, 913 strong, including 276 children, to drink punch laced with cyanide. Jones died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, findings of a newly discovered ancient civilization in what is now Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan in Central Asia, kept from the outside world in untranslated Soviet journals, have slowly emerged in the past decade. Archaeologists are buzzing about the civilization, which used irrigation to grow wheat and barley, forged distinctive metal axes, and painted pottery with elaborate designs. It appears to rival the sophistication of those civilizations that emerged in the Indus River Valley in Mesopotamia. Archaeologists conclude that the Central Asian civilization thrived between 2200 and 1800 BC. Newly discovered inscriptions on the Great Roman Colosseum suggest that the historic structure may have been constructed with the aid of booty that Roman legionaries took from the Temple on the Mount in Jerusalem in 70 AD. Roman inscriptions often told how buildings were paid for, but the ghost inscription that many scholars believe links the temple to the Colosseum has various holes which need to be further studied before any definite conclusion can be reached. The tentative explanation, however, is consistent with the established theory that Jewish booty helped pay for Roman overindulgence. This is Talking History. When did cheerleading begin? Who were the first cheerleaders? And how has it changed over the years? Talking History's Eileen Dugan poses these and other questions on the subject to historian Mary Ellen Hansen.
Pop quiz. What do the following people have in common? Franklin D. Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, Steve Martin, Vanna White, and Madonna. You guessed it. They were all cheerleaders. The people who have been attracted to cheerleading are as diverse as the activity itself. Cheerleaders have become a staple on the sidelines of most American team sports, with the curious exception of baseball. Whether they are the jumpsuited male yell leader of Texas A&M, the high school girl next door, or the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader or Laker girl. How did such a seemingly simple activity, getting the crowd to boost a team, become so complex? And why do we have such conflicting images of the cheerleader? With us today to explore the distinctly American tradition of cheerleading is Dr. Mary Ellen Hansen of the University of New Mexico. Dr. Hansen is the author of the book, Go, Fight, Win, Cheerleading in American Culture. Welcome, Dr. Hansen.
Thank you.
How did cheerleading actually begin?
It actually started as a very informal activity that students organized among themselves, and it happened at the college level, and the only people in college at the time, in the mid-1800s, were young men. So it began as a masculine activity exclusively.
And was it under the control of the university at the beginning?
Not at all. It was an outgrowth of the informal sports and competitions that the boys organized for themselves, for their own amusement.
And so who were the first cheerleaders?
We don't know who the first cheerleader actually was. It would have been a student or even an injured team member who was just there at the proceedings and took it upon himself to stand up and urge the crowd to boost the team.
And they would be standing on the sidelines, as I recall.
They would be on the sidelines, and actually, when this began, there probably weren't even seating or grandstands. But the spectators would literally be standing around the edge of a field where the team sports were taking place.
So how did cheerleading come to be under the authority of educational institutions?
It really grew out of the expansion and the institutionalization of collegiate athletics, which grew very rapidly. Intercollegiate athletics inspired a lot of interest on the part of alums as the schools developed their own history. There were more people following the history. The students themselves got more and more involved, and the proceedings got more elaborate. The schools themselves saw this as a way to increase alumni support and to kind of keep the students in line, keep them involved in that sort of activity rather than rioting and burning dormitories and that kind of thing, which actually was a fairly common occurrence in the mid-19th century at some schools.
I'm glad to hear that. That they were able to stop that. Did this authority of the educational institutions change cheerleading at all?
Yes, I would say it did. I mean, it certainly started off as a spontaneous thing where students might volunteer. It would be the same thing as the playground, where certain leaders emerge or certain stars emerge, and other students acknowledge that and give them that place in their own society. As it became more formalized, the criteria for cheerleading changed and began to incorporate things like leadership and citizenship and character, as well as just the personality or the verve that would lead someone to just volunteer and be a very charismatic leader. That continued to be a part of it, but then as the institution got involved, it kind of sanctioned more acceptable behavior and used cheerleading as a way to set these guys up as good examples, good citizens.
Is this the time when people actually had to audition to be cheerleaders as well?
That became a part of it, where people would audition and groups of faculty might be in a part of the selection process. The student body might vote, but then there might be a further round of review where faculty would have input, where the coaches might have input, and of course the very fact that they had coaches was part of the increased formalization and institutionalization of the whole athletic process.
When did women start to get involved in cheerleading?
I would love to be able to tell you the exact date, and again, no one knows that, but we certainly have evidence that women co-eds, I guess that's redundant, were involved in forms of spirit activity and cheerleading as early as the 1920s. And of course, that couldn't happen until women were able to participate in collegiate education. So land-grant universities gave women, more and more women, the chance to attend college and participate in these activities. And concomitant with the cheerleader, you know, the high-profile person right on the sidelines, there were also spirit groups, groups of students who would organize themselves, sit together in the audience, and cheer in unison. And it's certainly we certainly have evidence of girls participating at that level. It was almost like a glee club activity. They might wear uniforms and sit together and cheer in unison, both male and female students. And gradually, their leadership kind of emerged out of that, and they began to participate in the more conspicuous small groups of cheerleaders who would be out in front.
How readily were women accepted as equals in cheerleading?
There's certainly documentation that some people thought it was great, and other people resisted it quite actively, saying, you know, this wasn't a seemly activity for females. They couldn't do all the athletic tumbling and stunts, which were also coming to be a part of cheerleading. So there were various conflicting attitudes about that.
So far, we've been talking essentially about cheerleading at the collegiate level, but of course, mm-hmm. it starts to go to what you call the scholastic level, the high school and even earlier.
Yes.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, I would say not a lot of difference in the beginning. The high schools certainly were avidly imitating the collegiate experience. And the same process of informal athletics gradually being formalized and taken over by adult authority and kind of cleaned up and regimented, that was happening at the secondary school level simultaneously as it was happening at the collegiate level. The college level certainly led off. And then as more and more public schools got involved and more students attended public school, the pattern kind of replicated itself. And you can see that high school students are getting organized into sports as they are at the collegiate level, and the concomitant accoutrements, the marching bands, the hoopla, majorettes, spirit leaders, cheerleaders, that kind of thing, imitated the college level.
And were the scholastic cheerleading units co-ed as well?
Early on, they were primarily masculine, again imitating the collegiate level. But certainly by the 20s, girls began to participate at the high school level.
As cheerleading spread, it's almost inevitable that it becomes big business, it seems. How did that develop?
I suppose the early indications of that, 1927 seems to be kind of a banner year. Two published manuals, you know, How to Be a Cheerleader, came out that year. They were both authored by men who had been cheerleaders, and they were aimed at young men aspiring to be cheerleaders, or yell leaders, yell captains. That was the terminology then. The development of manuals certainly proceeded from the 20s onward. In terms of the entrepreneurship and the corporate involvement that we see today, that really began in the late 1940s. And there were certainly one of the most well-known people was Lawrence Herkimer, who had been a famous collegiate Yale leader in his own right. And he began offering clinics and classes in the late 1940s. And by 1952, he formed his own business, which offered clinics at colleges teaching students how to cheer. He branched out into the secondary level, and his company gradually began offering uniforms and publishing manuals of sample cheers and that kind of thing. So it really began to take off in the early 1950s.
And along with the cheerleading becoming a business, we also see the beginning of the professional cheerleader. How did that happen?
That's really interesting, too, because professional sports, and particularly football, were going through their own growth process and becoming more and more prevalent and popular. And there are early indications that professional teams would invite high school-age cheer squads to cheer at their games. Some teams actually developed their own troops of primarily females who would wear costumes and appear at games. But the real phenomenon took off with the Dallas Cowboys in 1972. In fact, prior to that time, the Cowboys had a high school co-ed team of cheerleaders at games. I think they were called the Bells and the Bows. And they were just high school kids. And that was not really a big deal. When Tex Schramm came in as the manager, he wanted more showbiz, more glamour, more marketing. And he hired a person who was given instructions to, you know, hire people who look like models, females, and have them dance and put on a real show for the crowd. And that was done, and as of 1972, they debuted, and they were active for a few years and were really just a local phenomenon, people who followed the Cowboys. And then with the advent of television and Super Bowls and that sort of thing, then the television mechanism really hooked onto the cheerleaders as a visual novelty, you know, a real selling point for viewers in the home audience. And that's what really took off.
And as it was called, the honey shot.
Yes. Yes. wholesome sort of soft porn, softer than soft porn, I would say. But obviously the appeal was there to entice male viewers. Here are pinup type girls in pinup type dresses dancing and shaking their stuff.
And were they really leading cheers?
No, and it's really a fundamental difference between the professional cheerleading and school or college cheerleading. It's not athletic in the sense of the acrobatics, the jumps, the lifts, that sort of thing, and they're not leading formal cheers. They're dancers, they're very skilled dancers, but they're performing to musical numbers, doing heavily rehearsed set pieces to music. They generally perform during the breaks and at halftime and before and after games.
Speaking of Texas, we have to raise the issue of the Texas cheerleader mom. As a scholar, how did you view that case?
I can only borrow another person's words. Someone who was reviewing one of the several TV movies that were based on this whole thing referred to it as a yummily grotesque true story. And it really is. To me, it embodies great tragedy, and it's tragic because it's based on triviality. And it's just totally fascinating and horrifying, I think, for us. It's a distortion of everything that we think about nurturing parents who support their children who are going through growth experiences in life. You know, you compete for something, you lose. You run in an election, you lose or win, whatever. And here is a mother so obsessed with her daughter, her 13-year-old daughter's success at being selected as a cheerleader at a junior high school that she would actually seriously envision knocking off a rival aspiring cheerleader's mother to make it easier for her own daughter to compete. It doesn't even make sense on a Machiavellian level, but it is truly fascinating to see what can happen when parental ambition just totally nullifies, you know, a child's individuality. It's just amazing.
Why do we tend to have such conflicting images of the cheerleader? The cheerleader is good or bad, spirited or vapid. We have so many conflicting images. I mean, why?
I think because we have so many conflicting images about what femininity means in our culture. And it embodies all of those same negatives and positives, and we often expect women and girls to embody both simultaneously, or else we demand that they exhibit one and not the other. It's a very mixed bag of cultural expectations. We have a lot of anxiety about female roles, vis-a masculine roles, feminine and masculine competing roles, sympathetic roles, interchangeable roles, and a lot of that is in flux. And I think the ambivalence that we have just reflects all of that. And it's so easy to focus on cheerleading as the cheerleader as a symbol of all of the above.
And how is this conflict portrayed in popular entertainment? I mean, American Beauty comes to mind, for example.
Mm-hmm. You can look at positive and negative stereotypes and find them everywhere in media, in literature, in children's literature, adult literature, movies, television, commercials. It's fascinating to me. Political cartoons, you name it. It's all there, and it's all over the map.
We have only a moment left, but what do you see as the current trends and the controversies in cheerleading today?
There's certainly the continuing issue of whether it should be considered a sport or an activity, and that has funding implications, and also gets back to, well, what's appropriate for girls to do? Should they be supportive of what boys are doing, or should they be competing in their own right? So that's one issue. And I think the rise of competitive cheerleading, which we haven't talked about much, is promoting such an aggressive, athletic, demanding style of cheerleading that we are seeing an increase in catastrophic injury for cheerleaders.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Mary Ellen Hansen of the University of New Mexico and author of the book, Go, Fight, Win, Cheerleading in American Culture.
One of the points on which nearly every commentator has agreed in the wake of the tragic events of September 11th is that the nation has come together to form a united front against those responsible for the terrorist attacks. The question history poses, however, is, will it last, or will the very act of being at war against a common enemy provoke disagreements over various domestic issues? That's the subject of this week's commentary by Sherman Dorn, professor of history at the University of South Florida.
If we are truly in a war now, we should expect domestic debates. A common myth about wartime is that everyone bands together. Yet in the past, wars have often opened arguments on common themes. Two in particular seem likely to appear now: moral consistency and the scope of federal powers. In World War II, the fight against the Nazis raised questions about racial segregation. How could we fight for democracy when we treated so many as second-class citizens? In 1941, labor leader A. Philip Randolph threatened a march on Washington to protest racial discrimination by defense contractors. The threat pushed President Franklin D. Roosevelt into the first order forbidding defense firm bias. In 1945, the League of United Latin American Citizens filed the first federal lawsuit that ended segregation in the school district. These wartime achievements planted the seeds of the modern civil rights movement. Today, we may fight against violent fanatics while religious militants are in our own midst. The president has benefited from ties to the religious right, but the Reverend Jerry Falwell blamed civil rights organizations and abortion rights activists for the September 11th attacks. President Bush quickly criticized Falwell, and one must wonder, will the president continue to confront religious extremism at home, lest it make the country appear hypocritical? A debate over the proper role of the federal government in wartime also has a history. During the Civil War, for example, Lincoln drafted soldiers and suspended the right of habeas corpus. During and after the war, the federal government also donated land for colleges, gave pensions to veterans and their families, and passed the first federal civil rights laws. Many of these acts were controversial. New Yorkers rioted against the draft in 1863, while many critics in the North called Lincoln a tyrant. After an 1883 Supreme Court decision, civil rights laws were largely dead until the modern civil rights movement. We now confront what was unthinkable in August. The federal government may bail out the commercial airline industry, nationalize airport security, mandate state cooperation in anti-terrorist task forces, and change laws on how banks release financial information on suspected criminals, key tenets of candidate Bush. Shrinking the role of the federal government and relying on free markets to balance social interests may no longer work for President Bush, leading a new and complex struggle. The core American ideals invoked as a cause for retaliation will also bring us heated debate that will challenge us to be consistent with the goals of national efforts and that will redefine, once again, the purpose of our federal government.
You've been listening to Sherman Dorn, professor of history at the University of South Florida and the author of Creating the Dropout. This is Talking History. Not that it wasn't a popular topic before September 11th, but the events of that day have prompted even greater interest in the city of New York and its history. If you're among those who want to know more about the city's past, Cindy Workman can tell you where to begin your search for information.
The New York Historical Society, located in New York City, has many wonderful exhibits that give you a sense of the history of New York, including Flophouse, Life on the Bowery, and The British in New York, that examines the close ties between Britain and the United States over three centuries. Currently, the Historical Society has a special exhibition that pays tribute to New York's bravest, the firefighters. Included in the exhibit is a 1992 interview with Fire Chief William Feehan, who died in the collapse of the World Trade Center on September 11th. Also featured is a statue of Harry Howard, the first chief of the department, and the 34-star flag that was flown outside the home of lawyer William Horn in 1865. The museum is also currently gathering more stories of the people and the events of September 11th. The Historical Society is inviting New Yorkers to share their memories of that event.
And finally, turning to our segment on coming attractions, visitors to a unique exhibit of Syrian artifacts at the First USA Riverfront Art Center in Wilmington, Delaware, will find more than the usual checklist of dates and display cases. Syria, Land of Civilizations, provides a fascinating array of artifacts, as well as a timely sense of the shared humanity that links societies across time and space. The exhibit opens with a quotation from the Prophet Muhammad, "The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr." It closes with a message from a poet of the period that offers another perspective applicable to today's global situation. "Do not believe that I am a stranger. We are all sons of the same homeland, Earth." The idea of shared roots is the theme of the exhibit, organized by the Musée de la Civilisation in Quebec City, Canada. Advisor to the exhibit, Michael Fortin, a professor at Laval University in Quebec, explains, "Syria is one of the best, if not the best, example of where civilization began. It is important to remind people of their ties to this and other ancient civilizations." The exhibit, Syria, Land of Civilization, at the First USA Riverfront Arts Center in Wilmington, Delaware, closes December 9th, but reopens in February at the Fernbank Museum of Natural History in Atlanta, Georgia. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.